Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, here I am, Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and did you know that Bookworm has been on 30 years? And one of the things that I'm happiest about is that you go back through the Bookworm archives and you hear so much literary history. Part of that history, inevitably, since this Bookworm is a show that comes from Los Angeles, includes the beginning of the career of Dennis Cooper. Eventually, after his five George Miles novels, he moves to Paris. I visit him there. We do an interview with a choreographer he was working with named Giselle Vienne. And now, he's making movies. He's making movies with a partner named Zach Farley. They've made two films so far, and somehow I have connected the history of Dennis Cooper and his varying projects and enterprises with the history of Bookworm because, well, in a certain sense, we grew up together, and it's a great pleasure to have him and Zach here, the occasion being their second film called Permanent Green Light. And I guess I'll ask to begin with, what does that title mean to you?
The title doesn't really mean particularly anything. It just sort of feels really connected to the film, and it has this kind of like beautiful weight in your throat or something.
That's Zach.
Yeah, we just love the title.
Just, you know, a permanent green light. It's really pretty literal, right? It's like if you had a permanent green light, you could keep going and you could do anything and you would never stop. And somehow that seems like interestingly connected to the main character's idea of reaching a kind of spectacular nothingness.
The main character is named Roman, right?
Mm-hmm.
And for him, a permanent green light is permanent permission to explore. He would like to be able to disappear, leaving nothing behind. This is not a desire to die. This is a desire to leave, like the 4th of July fireworks he's looking at, a fantastic display, and then nothing. And that would be his green light. He doesn't really see much beyond that. And around him are an assembly of friends and relatives. He has a sister who are not exactly sure what he's talking about when he speaks of this desire to disappear. Because he doesn't speak it in terms that you would associate with a suicide. He speaks of it in terms associated with a magic act, disappearance. Now, help me. Where does this come from?
There was a news story 2-3 years ago about a teenager in Australia named Jake Bilardi. He disappeared. It was a big mystery. No one understood what happened to him. And then it turned out that he had joined ISIS and was in Syria. And he ultimately went on a suicide bombing mission, in which he failed and only blew himself up. The interesting thing about it was that every guy read obsessively about it, and everyone who knew him said this made absolutely no sense. There was no sense in him, that he had no ideology, he had no religious beliefs, no politics. He was like a guy who coached soccer with younger kids. So what interested what me and Zach also about it is that this idea that maybe what if he had tried to erase himself? What if he had found, he had chosen a context that was so loaded that his own existence or his own purpose or anything would be erased, and no one would ever really understand what happened or why he did it, and he would die in you know, not as a person but as a piece of this puzzle, this, you know, this cause. We both found that really interesting, and then we just kind of extracted out of that and developed this character who wanted to die as an act of a spectacular act in which his own death would be meaningless.
Yes, and meaninglessness is important to him because he's surrounded by people who are trying to make their lives meaningful, trying to make the fact that they're perhaps in love with one another meaningful. They want to touch, but they're afraid to. They want to be in love, but they don't know what that would mean. It's a very mysterious movie in that what I was expecting was a bunch of very lackluster and benumbed kids, but they're not. They're kids. They seem real. They're kids living in an environment that includes all sorts of world devastation that they don't know how to begin to respond to or even to name. In other words, like kids now. Now, I know Dennis is a novelist. Zach, tell me, you were studying filmmaking at CalArts? Do I have that right?
I was actually in the art school at CalArts, and I studied, visual arts more broadly. I was always really interested in film, but not to the point of going to film school, if that makes sense. I guess what I was most thrilled about was editing. The practice of editing was like always something that really, really thrilled me for its potential and for the possibilities to kind of connect things and make new paths through images and sounds. And yeah, I met Dennis, and we started making a film.
As I understand it, you'd read his work before you met him.
Yeah, I was really obsessed with his work growing up, and he was sort of the author that got me excited about literature, really, and what literature could do that I didn't suspect it could until that point.
I think Dennis has been a permanent green light to a lot of people, and in particular, his blog. What is it called now?
DC's.
DC's. And on it, I go there still after many, many years to find suddenly that it's Joy Williams Day. And as much information as can be collected about Joy Williams, interviews and private bits, you'll come away knowing how to start to read Joy Williams if you haven't read her before. This is, as I understand it, there's going to be a Raymond Roussel Day coming up, perhaps.
There already has been one.
Uh-huh. And, wow.
Yeah, it's books, films. I'm really obsessed with amusement parks. There's a lot about amusement parks and haunted houses and bulk. It's kind of all over the place, yeah.
And it is, for many people, I think, for many young people, the doorway in. I met Dennis. I was pretty fully involved with literature. There was no question about it, literature and poetry. But I'd never really been to or cared about music, rock music. And Dennis started taking me out when I was living here, to the Starwood, which is gone, to the Whiskey when it was a really happening place. 2-3 nights a week, I was going to rock concerts. I couldn't believe it was me because I kept saying to Dennis, but aren't these just annoying kids who are trying to become famous? He said, no, not at all. Not the kind of music I'm interested in. These are kids who are taking on the opportunity to have their own voice. And sometimes their voice is a very silent one. He explained to me that there was certain music where the music is drowning out the voices and the lyrics, and that's really the subject. Well, that's sort of the subject here, too, that this Roman is being, in a sense, drowned out, not just by his desire to disappear, but by the people around him who want to make more sense of life than he's capable of making it make, yeah?
Right, right. I mean, I think Zach too. We think about it so much about aesthetics and structure and things like that. So, it's more about creating balances and things. I mean, he's very idiosyncratic, but he's enormously intelligent, and he's very reticent, but he's very articulate, and all the people around him needed to be as well, because we needed to create this kind of evenness so that he didn't stand out. He wasn't that he, apart from his obsession, I mean, it made sense that he knew these people. They all had a certain kind of intelligence. They were all rather poetic in their thoughts and things. So it was more about, I think for me, it was more about that, just creating this kind of like something. So there was this consistency or atmosphere or something that would make everything kind of even out. And then the details would come through something.
I'm talking to Dennis Cooper, one of the great alumni of Bookworm, and his work partner, Zach Farley. They've been making films together, most recently Permanent Green Light. Now, I have to say that this didn't strike me as being a depressive film at all.
It's no. Kind of a comedy.
Yeah. Tell me.
Well, I mean, it's... if you read the script, I mean, it seems like a comedy. I don't know. We just had an idea about the tone. It is very funny, and the language is very clever in this way that is humorous, even when they're talking about dark things. But we wanted the humor to be like, it was like a mix, like mixing music or something. We wanted it to be lower in the mix so that you wouldn't immediately get the humor. I mean, the idea of the film is that you have to search and find things. You have to search their faces for what they're feeling. You have to search their strange sentences for what they really mean, and at the same time, and the tone too. You have to search. You have to kind of really search the film to find exactly what's going on there, which is something we thought was really interesting and something we're both really interested in.
Yeah, I don't think about it as a depressive film at all. We were making a film about someone who wants to disappear and actually sort of like giving. Like making the world where that would be a possibility, where that wouldn't immediately be impossible, where the kind of contradiction or the competing impulses of like really, really wanting to accomplish something and really wanting to not actually make any kind of direct and palatable motion.
They are looking at their friend as if, is he going to do it? Yes, he's taken certain moves. He's found a girl who collects suicide vests. He has one himself, but he's not connected to any of the iconography attached to that. It may simply facilitate his disappearance. And you know, I think that one of the pleasures of literature and poetry is to suspend expectation, to let yourself say, no, this isn't a suicidal kid. This is a kid who is interested in magic. And isn't that, in its own way, beautiful? That's what he leaves behind.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah, I really agree with that as a description for literature. And more, I mean, the character is on this kind of a quest. And really, when we're making the film, I mean, we are too. We're asking all of these questions, not so much with the intention of answering them or giving you an answer, but as a kind of exercise. And the film is really, it's really the right place for that exercise. It's like our quest and the quest of the main character are linked in this way.
Yeah, I mean, he kind of said it's like the film was, I thought of the film as like, how could he succeed? Because he can't succeed. It's an impossible thing he's trying to do. But trying to construct the film such that, I mean, you acknowledge at the end by the expression on his friends' faces who've just watched it that it didn't succeed. But how could we possibly make this succeed? And the viewer, having the viewer, because we worked very hard to make him not sympathetic and not so that you would not be sad when he died. You would just be interested in him. So.
The lips of this character, Roman, seemed profoundly thick.
And they are.
there was something beautiful about the camera's interrogation of these characters and their features. Because, you see, one of the things we forget, no matter what you do, a film is going to be over. And if you haven't looked closely enough, you lose whatever it was you saw. So better retain, better remember. Also, literature, it seems to me, is about the achievement of the impossible. Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment is not going to be Napoleon. He's just murdering a pawnbroker woman who doesn't deserve to die in any sense. The nobility of Raskolnikov's cause is in Dostoevsky's relation to you, the reader, not Raskolnikov's relation to the pawnbroker.
Right.
And the characters in Crime and Punishment are all arrayed as a prostitute whose job is to save him. But who can be saved? Mm-hmm. Who can be saved who's already committed a murder? So one impossibility piles atop the other to make of literature a series of miracles. And I think that's what's meant to happen in this film, that these young people who need so badly, one of them is practically begging, can I pay you to sleep with me? What could cause this to happen? Under what circumstance? Will you sleep with me before you disappear? Will disappearing make it possible? And that devoted need for the impossible to happen on multiple levels seems to me to be what the film is about, huh?
Sure. And it's not a coincidence that it's very much a language film. I mean, it's like most of the film happens in what they say. It's very, very important. And that is sadly an unusual thing in films. I mean, language is the least concern of most films. But that's partially gives it that quality is because you have to search the language and you have to pay attention and you have to think about it and stuff. And it screws with the time frame of watch, you know, the way you watch a film, the tempo of the film and all that stuff is part of why that I think it works.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Dennis Cooper and Zach Farley about their film Permanent Green Light. They are collaborators. They're not writer and director. They both have worked in different intensities in both regards. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Dennis Cooper and Zach Farley about their film Permanent Green Light, a cinematic narrative about teens pondering the art of dying, the act of vanishing, and the reality of ephemerality. Hey, didn't that sound interesting?
That was good.
I have a wonderful producer who wrote that. That was by my producer, Sean. He's a great plus for this program.
Yeah, we may have to ask him if we can use that, actually.
How can people who've become interested thus far see the film? What do they have to do? Does it have a distributor, first of all?
There's a distributor in the United States called Altered Innocence. It will. It's getting some kind of very small release sometime fairly soon. And then it will be streaming in DVD. So eventually people will be able to either stream it or buy the DVD.
You did this film in France, and it's in French with English subtitles. What does it take to raise money and make a film in France?
France is one of those countries where there is public funding for cinema. So there's a state funding agency called the CNC that is made up of filmmakers and writers and producers, various producers that meet and discuss projects that are proposed to them and decide whether or not to allocate funds towards their making. So this is a combination of, tax dollars and anytime you buy a movie theater ticket in France, a large portion of that goes towards making cinema.
Once upon a time, cinema in France included Godard and Bresson, Romare, truly amazing filmmakers whose works I still go to see. Old ones, new ones, you know, they're very important to me. Does film still mean in Paris what it used to mean in those days of the new wave? Is there anything like that intensity?
It's different. I mean, there's certainly more interest in cinema in France, and I mean, in Paris, at least in France, than there is here. I mean, there still is a great respect for cinema, and there's an enormous number of films being shown over and over and over. You can see older films a lot. I mean, and there are very interesting younger or newer filmmakers making films, so that continues. But I mean, most French films are just dross.
Uh-huh.
I'm sorry, but they're just worse than here. I mean, that you'd never know these films. They never get released outside of France. But
help me, where is world cinema now?
Scattered?
Thailand, Japan.
Middle East. But there's a burgeoning movement of these underground filmmakers. I'm actually sort of getting to know these people. And they're all over the place. And there's a kind of scene, and they're starting to show films of abstract films that were interested in, you know, Brackage and Hollis Frampton. And so there's a kind of, that really excites me. So there's that. But I think it's pretty scattered. I don't think, there's not a center like France or like Germany was. I don't think there's anything like that right now.
Now, the two of you, since you, Zach, were a reader of Dennis's books, and you are the writer of Dennis's books, to what extent does this film, do you feel, join the body of your work?
I think in its concerns, it's exactly the deepest point of my work, and it's what my work has always been about. The difference is that it's not about lust, basically. It's not about objectification and lust. I mean, that's the one thing it's not. It's people who are relating to one another in terms of just some kind of friendship. It's more about friendship. So it's interesting to me to get that kind of like violent impulse and, you know, desire and an out. Because to me, even though I've worked with that all my life, those are not what those books are about. So it was beautiful to be able to kind of distill it to really purely what I'm interested in personally, for me.
And are you a facilitator for that perspective?
I don't consider myself to be. I think desire is there in the film, and I think so I don't think it's wholly absent. Maybe I'm really maybe the worst person in the world to talk about the any real relationship between Dennis's work and my film, because I have too much respect for the novel.
Well, it must be very. That's why I'm asking. It must be very confusing.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, we share so many interests. I mean, it's not like he's adapting something I do. We are really deeply interested in almost the same things. That's why the reasons why we work together and work so well together.
Yeah, I mean, I think that confusion is productive. It's. I don't feel like I'm, you know, going in and changing Dennis's work or anything when we work on films together. It really does feel like an incredible collaboration, and I mean, we're setting ourselves up to make these what to us seem like extremely ambitious projects, where we actually aren't sure we're going to be able to make them until they're complete.
As I understand it, there are two or three in the works right now.
Yeah, we're working on a new film. It's really exciting, very different, very ambitious.
I don't talk much with writers of memoirs, but if there's a novelist who's written a memoir, I want to talk to him or to her or to them. And similarly, if a writer has made a film, I want to take my little teaspoon and scoop up what it is that connects the film. Because, you know, there's a conversation. Rudy Wurlitzer once said it to me, that the conversation is being stilled. And there's a conversation that has to go on among artists, in which artists remind their audiences that we're all in conversation, that it's here, and that without it, the art dies, and then shortly thereafter, the conversation dies too. And so thank you for coming here and talking to us.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you so much. It's like a dream.
It's a great pleasure to me, too. I've been talking with Dennis Cooper and Zach Farley. They are partners, writers, directors of the film Permanent Greenlight, distributed in USA and Canada by Altered Innocence. It almost sounds like the name of a distribution company made for this film. Thank you for joining me. You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show. Also available at Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Plus, you can listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. Special thanks to my already named co-producer and assistant, Sean Sullivan. Alan Howard, also here, is associate producer and editor. Our technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
A bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Chloe Arregis is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.